Count to 10 again.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
This is Bob Brown. I'm interviewing Paul Ringling on May 30th, 2013 in Helena, Montana. Paul, where and when were you born?
Where? I was born in New York City on 4, that'd be April 21st, 1920.
Who were your parents and what was their occupation?
My father's name was Richard T. Ringling. His occupation was at that time starting to ranch in Montana and was the son of one of the original Ringling brothers, Alf T. Ringling, that founded the circus.
Now tell me about that. Tell me about the founding of the circus.
The circus, the Ringling brothers, the five brothers, started their circus in 1884 at Baraboo, Wisconsin.
And they traveled around the country. They had a big top tent and elephants and that sort of thing.
When they first started in 1884, there were their brothers and four or five performers, and they traveled not by railroad then, by wagon, hired teams from farmers around Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and that territory. And they operated what in the vernacular of the circus you would call a mud show, because they traveled around the country with teams. And they didn't go on the railroad until 1889. So the 4 years, and then on the off part of the season, they worked. Their father was a harness maker, and they all knew how to trim wagon and buggies, and worked in the winter time. And then part of the time in the winter, they had where they played in halls, hall shows type things, sang, danced, and performed themselves.
So it wasn't so much what we would think of as a circus to begin with.
Well, it was a circus, but it was a circus that traveled, but with horses.
Yeah.
And then when they first started, they didn't have all the animals that they had later.
It was a troupe of entertainers, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
So was there acting and singing and that sort of thing in their family that attracted them
to
that business?
Well, yes, they all acted and sang and played instruments. My grandfather was quite an accomplished musician on the violin, and my uncle, Charles Ringling, was a very excellent saxophone player.
And they were a part of the original five, your
yes.
grandfather was.
Yes.
Now, what's the connection to P.T. Barnum? Because I think of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus as though they must have merged or something. Explain that.
The Ringling Brothers bought out from James Bailey's estate. The Ringling Brothers bought the Barnum and Bailey bought the Barnum and Bailey Circus in 1907.
I see.
And they operated the circus separate from Ringling Brothers until 1919, when they combined them into what you know as Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey.
Did your grandfather have any connection to P.T. Barnum, or was he dead by then?
Barnum at that time had died.
I see. And so his estate had been, or his interest in the circus had been taken over by Bailey.
Yes.
And then your family bought the circus from Bailey. Was there anything left over from Phineas T. Barnum, of course, is a well-known character in American history. I think he's the guy that said there was a sucker born every minute. And...
Well, that's what he's that's what he's quoted as saying. But then my grandfather and my uncle John Ringling were the brothers. I'll back up a little bit. The Ringling Brothers were a partnership, the brothers. They were a partnership that never had a partnership agreement and had a joint bank account.
Huh.
But anyway, the brothers, the business, the brothers, decided that my grandfather and John Ringling, my uncle, would go to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and operate the Barnum and Bailey Circus, which they did. My grandmother charged my grandfather with desertion and divorced him.
Now, your grandfather's first name was?
Alf, A-L-F.
Okay.
Middle initial T
for
Theodore.
And his wife divorced him?
Yes.
Yeah. And
charged him with desertion.
See, for going to Connecticut.
Yeah.
And where did they live at the time?
Baraboo, Wisconsin.
Was Baraboo, Wisconsin?
Yes.
Now, what was the connection to Montana?
Well, my uncle John Ringling came to Marr County about the same, in Marr County, White Sulphur Springs, about the at the same time that the Milwaukee Railroad was built. And speculated, what he actually did, he speculated in land in Marr County. White Sulphur Springs is the county seat. And my father came there to do some business and look at his uncle's property, and that's where he met my mother.
And about when was this?
My mother and father were married in White Sulphur Springs in 1918, but John Ringling would have came there about 1908.
And what was the attraction? Was it just that he read or something that there was a good opportunity to buy land in that area? Or?
Well, my uncle, this is John Ringling now we're speaking about. He speculated in land in Montana, in Oklahoma, in Missouri, in Florida. John Ringling was... And the land that he bought in Oklahoma, what he was interested in was coal.
Oh.
But the coal never amounted to anything, but they found oil all over it. and he became quite a wealthy man from this oil income that he had. And there's a little town, Ringling, also in Oklahoma.
Oh. Well, there's a Ringling, Montana, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's south of White Sulphur Springs, between White Sulphur Springs and Wilsall.
So your dad, whose first name was?
Richard.
Richard. And your mother?
My mother was born and raised in White Sulphur Springs.
And what was her name?
Aubrey. Not Audrey, but Aubrey. A-U-B-R-E-Y. Her father wanted a son. Course, and had a daughter, but he already had the name picked, so he just named her Aubrey.
And the maiden name, her maiden
Black.
Name? Black. Okay, and that was a family established in Montana.
Yes,
at that time?
My grandparents on my mother's side came from Kentucky.
I see.
And they came to Montana, and his uncle was Preston Leslie, the last territorial governor of Montana.
Okay.
And stopped to see his uncle in Helena, here where we are right now.
Yeah.
And they planned to go in.
Now, this is Richard who stopped to see his uncle.
No.
Oh, excuse me. Black, your mother's father.
Yes.
Yeah.
My grandfather, Black. His first name was Powell.
I got you.
Powell
okay.
Black. And
he was the nephew of Preston Leslie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And his uncle, Preston Leslie, told him that the coming town in Montana was White Sulphur Springs. My grandfather was an attorney, so he went to White Sulphur Springs and had a law practice there.
Now, so your side of the family also invested in land, but you didn't strike any oil.
Well, my father invested in land, and then he was became a rancher, but also owned one-third of the circus.
Okay. And so he remained in the circus business as well as in the ranching business over
at
White Sulphur.
Yes.
And how long did he remain in the circus business before the circus closed?
Well, my father died when he was 36. I was only 11 years old when my father died. So that one-third interest in the circus then went to my mother.
I see.
And that's when I graduated from high school. I was 17, went to work on the circus.
What did you do?
Well, the first 2 years, and I'm saying years, but it's actually seasons, because the circus operated from April until November. The first 2 years I worked in the ticket department. The second 2 years I worked with the layout and setting up the circus. What we called a squadron. The circus moved in four sections, and the squadron was the first section. Our normal time to get up was 3:30 in the morning, but by 6 you were served breakfast. But by 10 we were through. I mean, we were still obviously employees, but our job was more, by 10 in the morning we were pretty well through.
I see.
And the last year that I worked on the circus, 1941, I checked outdoor advertising. So I was about 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks ahead of the circus. The outdoor advertising was the one sheets in the stores, the billboards. That was the first year that we had the ads on the Railway Express trucks that are no longer in existence. But anyway, that was my job in 1941, checked outdoor advertising.
And then I presume you went into the military?
In 1942.
And what became of the circus? Was it sold?
Well, the circus still was in the family, and my mother sold her interest in the circus I have to come up with the right year. She sold her interest in about 49.
I see. How long after that did the circus remain in existence, do you know?
Well, the circus is still in existence.
Oh, it is.
But it's no longer owned by any of my family.
I see.
But it's actually still operating.
Out of Baraboo, Wisconsin?
No. Now out of Florida.
I see.
And for years it was Sarasota, Florida, okay. But now it's down in Venice, in Florida.
So you grew up in and around White Sulphur Springs.
Yes.
And you went away to the military. You were 21 years old or 22 years old when you went into the Army?
I was first in the Army Signal Corps and then the Air Corps.
And where were you stationed?
Well, in the United States, I, of course, went to the base camp down in California. Then I went to radio school and lived in a hotel in Kansas City and went straight from there to North Africa.
I see. And you were in the regular Army or the Army Air Corps?
I was first in the Army Signal Corps.
Oh, yeah.
And then later the Air Corps.
Yeah. My dad was in North Africa in the Army Air Corps, too.
But it wasn't Army Air Corps, it was Air Corps.
Oh, I see.
Okay. It was the Army Signal Corps.
Yeah.
But the Air Corps was a separate branch.
I see.
And then later I was in Italy.
Yeah, my dad was too. Yeah. For a while he was attached to the British 8th Army, I think, when they were in North Africa.
The unit I was in, we worked totally with the British.
Yeah.
100% with the British. Yeah. Our orders came from Cheadle outside of London.
Yeah, yeah. And then do you remember in Italy, were you at Foggia?
Yes, I was at Foggia. But we, for most of the time I was in Italy, Bari's on the Adriatic. It was about 30 miles from Bari.
Okay, all right. Well, I think you and my dad might have shared rations together. I think you, it sounds like you followed the same pattern pretty much in World War II. So you returned from the war.
Yes.
And you went back to the ranch at White Sulphur Springs, or did you go to college?
I went to school on the GI Bill, and then my wife and I, we were married in 1940, so we'd been married going on 2 years when I went into service. But when I came home, and my wife had gone to the Butte Business College when I went into service, and then she worked all the time during the, and when I came home, she quit her job. We rented a cabin over on Lake McDonald and got reacquainted. And then later that, and then I went to school on the GI Bill.
At Montana State or?
Yes.
In Bozeman.
At Bozeman.
Yeah. And I assume majored in some, like, range management or?
I took all ag courses, but I never graduated. I went back. My mother was having problems. Well, I did plan to go back on the circus. And then there was family feuds going on. And pardon my French, but I said, the hell with it. I went back to the ranch. And my mother was having problems on the ranch.
So you took over the management of the ranch.
Yes.
Now, Paul, you got into politics in 1952, so you hadn't been back on the ranch very long when that happened.
Right.
What motivated that?
I don't think I can give you a good answer. I think I disagreed probably with our then, you understand, that's the old Constitution.
Yes. The 1889 Constitution.
Yes. And I think...
You had one representative for all of Marr County.
Well, every county in Montana.
At least one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And every county had a senator.
Right.
And Yellowstone County, Silver Bowl County, up at Great Falls, Cascade County, Missoula, I'm not sure, but anyway, Yellowstone County had about five in the House.
Yeah.
And Silver Bowl County had six, I think. But the rest of the county, most all the counties had one of each, yes.
And so you had a disagreement with the...
I think probably I didn't think that our representative then was representing maybe the county or
who was he?
His last name was Rosted.
Rosted, okay. That's an old political family in the central part of the state, yeah.
Yes.
In fact, I served with Carl Rosted.
Well, Carl was his brother.
Okay.
And Carl and I were really good personal friends. Carl was a county commissioner, and we used to go together to meetings. Carl and I were good friends.
Yeah.
But it was his brother that I defeated.
Do you remember anything about the issue or anything that was involved? Just that?
No, not. No. And of course, I had to decide whether, if you're going to be in politics, you have to decide what you are.
Well, you anticipated my next question.
And I think I became a Democrat because I disagreed with Democrats less than I disagreed with the Republicans. And of course, from Marr County, White Sulphur Springs, I think, now you can check this, but I think I'm the, when I was later in the Senate, I think I'm only the only Democrat senator from that county from about 1920 till right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty heavily Republican part of the state, that's for sure. So there was a philosophical difference between the two parties at that time, and you agreed with the Democrats a little more than you agreed with the Republicans, or you disagreed with them a little bit less. Explain how you saw the difference in the two parties then.
Well, then you must remember that the Anaconda Company and Montana Power, which people forget about Montana Power, between the two of them, they ran Montana, especially with the Anaconda Company. And they gave just enough slack that the state could operate. But the one thing that they were interested in was education. I have to give them credit for that. So they funded the university system, they were kind of hold the money back maybe on other things, but they funded the university system. And I say they, we, the legislators.
How did they do that? How did they exercise control over the legislature?
They controlled enough legislators. They didn't obviously control all of them, but they controlled the majority.
How?
When you paid your power bill, when you paid your Montana power bill, you could go, instead of mailing in your money, you paid your bill at a local grocery store or a drugstore or something. They had a large ad in every weekly paper. Every week there was a phosphate ad or something for the Anaconda company. So they subsidized the papers.
The little weekly newspapers.
The weekly newspapers. They subsidized the businesses in a business in the town where everybody went to buy their drugs or their groceries or something like that. And they entertained here in Helena. And then you remember those days when the legislature met for 60 days and every day counted.
There was
every day counted.
Now, Paul, explain again how you received your Montana power bill in the mail, and then you said you could go to a grocery store?
Yes, and pay your bill.
How does that work?
Well, you just walked in, you paid your bill, right? I mean,
paid it to the grocer?
Pardon me?
Paid the bill to the grocer?
No, you paid the bill to the Montana power, but you gave the check or your cash or however you paid it to the grocer, and of course the grocer transferred it.
So how did that benefit the grocer?
Well, they probably got a percentage.
I see.
I don't know that, but they obviously were.
Yeah.
Got,
so what this was a kind of a big organized operation where people in the grocery business, people in the newspaper business, maybe other small business people were all sort of in a way a part of the big Anaconda Company, Montana Power Company business operation.
That's correct.
And so I see that.
Well, every little town had we'll say they had a Rotary Club. So they subsidized the Rotary Club, you know. That one, if you worked for the Montana Power, for instance, you had to belong to the Rotary Club. You were a member and active in that.
Yeah.
That was part of your job.
And the Rotary Club was influential in most little communities.
Right.
And explain the connection between the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company.
Well, they worked together up here in the legislature, but the Anaconda Company, the room was 621 in the Placer. Every afternoon they had drinks and snacks and entertained the legislators. The Montana Power had a separate room, and they didn't do as much of mostly they were there, but they worked together up during the session.
The Montana Power Company's room might have been where they did research, and that was more of an office, but the Anaconda Company's room 621 was where, that was called, I think it was called a watering hole? Or
the
water
hole, yes.
Yeah. And were there other water holes?
I think the railroads had one, but the main one was the Anaconda.
Describe it.
Well, there was a room upstairs in the Placer. Well, 621, that was the room.
Yeah.
And if someone had a birthday or there was something, then they had a little special party. Well, now, I've been to 621, but it wasn't a regular there, but when there was a special thing, then I would go. And I remember one time when we walked in, some of us Democrats, and there was a Republican legislator who says, "What are those Democrats doing in a Republican club?" And I remember the Anaconda guy just chewed him out. He says, "This is not a Republican club."
But Paul, when you got interested in politics, to get back to my original question, it was because you felt that the Republicans, I think you just said it, were closer to this big business combination that controlled Montana politics than the Democrats were. Would you say, though, that there were still some Democrats who were closely involved with the Anaconda Company and a part of their...
Oh, yes. When, especially the delegates from Silver Bow County, from Cascade County. So that first session, when I was in the legislature, 1953, there were 26 of us Democrats that voted together.
Huh.
Sometime, and then in some, you'd have a standing vote, and, you know, the, if you're for or against, whatever. The group from where I sat, right in front of us was the group from Silver Bow. Well, they'd be standing up, we'd be sitting down.
And that might involve votes that the Anaconda Company or the Montana Power Company had an interest in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you remember names?
Well, sure. And you realize you're talking to an old guy that sometimes, like day after tomorrow, I'll tell you the answer. But yes, when I was, well, Neil Graybill was a minority leader.
And he was a Democrat from Great Falls.
Yes. Bob Durkee from Hill County was a Democrat. Said we, Bob and I, were seatmates.
But before, tell me a little bit about Leo. Was he a part of your 26 group, or was
yes.
he? Okay.
Oh, yes. Yes. Leo was, did you know Leo?
Well, if we're talking about the same guy, he was the chairman of the Constitutional Convention.
No, that was his son.
I see. Okay.
There were two.
Okay.
They had the same name. But
yes,
Leo,
okay.
Leo was an attorney and always dressed up, you know, real dress and particular that to follow the rules, the dignity of the legislature. He was pretty well oriented around that type. And then in 55, he was a speaker.
I see. And Bob Durkee, I knew from Haber.
Bob was from Hill County.
Yeah.
From Haver.
He was a lobbyist for the Tavern Keepers Association.
Yes, that was later.
Yeah.
But Bob and I were seatmates and good friends during the legislature.
And he was part of your group?
Yes.
Who?
Fred Barrett from Liberty County.
Who I also knew.
Yes,
yeah.
Fred was part of that group.
His father-in-law, I think, was Leonard Plank, who was also a senator from up in that country.
Yes.
Sometime back in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
And I interviewed him before I was doing these recorded interviews. But that was many years ago. It was a wonderful interview. Who do you remember from the Butte Anaconda delegation?
Well, let me think.
Someone who might be
might
stand out in your memory as particularly close to the Anaconda Company.
I'm trying to think, come up with the names now. Well, right now, I have to dodge that question because I can't come up with those names.
They were...
And obviously, I knew them all.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't remember there was a particular leader of their delegation? Or?
Yes, and an attorney that was from Butte and that was in the Senate, I would say, be their leader, but... Darn it, right now I can't think of it.
Okay.
I just can't come up with that name.
Let me see here. Did you have any, when you got to the Montana legislature in 1953, do you remember any first impressions? Do you remember, is there a memory that stands out in your mind?
Well, what I can remember is you didn't hardly know how to get in and out the doors, you know. And pretty darn green when you first went to the legislature. And I sat and listened and tried to learn what was going on. And I learned a lot by watching, and I had his name right, and now I can't, I'll think of it. But anyway, on the Republican side was a House member from down I think his home, Carbon County.
George O'Connor?
George O'Connor. Well, I'll tell you, there's George O'Connor really knew the Montana House had terrible rules for a legislative body. Their rules were the Roberts Rules of Order, which are terrible for a legislative thing. But George knew those rules, and I watched him because I said he pitched us into the gobloons about four times a day. You know, by your seat was a gobloon. So you know what I'm talking about?
Spittoon?
Yeah, spittoon.
Yeah.
But I watched George, and that you need to know the rules, but you also could do anything you could get away with, and I learned that from George O'Connor just by watching him.
Yeah.
And we knew each other, and we weren't unfriendly, but we weren't really friends either.
Yeah.
And Ori Armstrong was another one
from Kalispell.
Yes.
Was he the speaker at that time? He was speaker once.
No, but he wasn't a speaker then, but he was real active in his party.
What do you remember about him?
Well, I kind of liked Ori, and I remember at the end of the 53 session, and this you probably won't believe, Ori said we didn't do too badly, and we balanced the state budget for $23 million.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Can you believe that now? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, he was a very prominent citizen in Kalispell when I was a little kid. But getting back to George O'Connor, do you know what became of him?
Yes, he went to work for the Montana Power, and I think he worked there till he retired.
And I believe he was the CEO, wasn't he, the chief executive officer?
He worked his way up.
He was high up in the Montana Power Company anyway.
Right.
So that tends to underscore your connection between prominent politicians in Montana and the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company. Do you remember anything about it, Ori Armstrong? I mean, other than... George O'Connor, it's fairly well known, had a wonderful mastery of the rules.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But Ori was a leader in his party, but I don't remember some exceptional things that... You know, those fellas, they worked kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Paul, I interviewed a fellow, again, it wasn't a recorded interview, by the name of Bill Kirkpatrick. And Bill Kirkpatrick was the Western General Counsel for the Anaconda Company. I believe their lead lobbyist, at least in Montana and maybe in other parts of the country too, because I think they had holdings in Arizona as well.
Yes.
And he told me about the watering hole because he was there in 1953 and 1955. So I think he was the main guy in terms of their lobbying operation. And he told me that typically that their watering hole would be open for a couple of hours, I guess, I don't know, at the end of the legislative day.
Well, they would be open at least for 2 hours. We'll say from 5 to 7,
yeah.
Or maybe 4:30 to 7:30 or something.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And they had snacks, but mostly drinks and conversation.
Uh-huh.
And then when there would be a birthday party or something special, then they'd have a little extra.
And so... But I've heard stories that they sometimes had heavy hors d'oeuvres, like maybe a baron of beef or something like that.
Well, that would have been...
For a party, maybe?
At the time when I was there, I don't remember ever being there when there was a baron of beef, but it could have been. But
well, the story was that there were some guys who were kind of poor who maybe basically had their evening meal there sometimes.
There was some... That one legislator from Jordan, east of Jordan, I think he just lived on free food. And
do you remember who that was?
Yes, and I sometimes John McDonald was in the house, and I'll think of his name before.
Was it Spear?
No, Spear was from down in, Junior Spear was.
Down toward Hardin, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with that county name down there.
Well, probably Bighorn.
Yeah, would have been Bighorn County. That was Junior Spear, but Junior could, you know, he could pay his way anywhere.
Sure, yeah. So, and it wasn't McDonald either, who was a Democrat.
John was a Democrat, and the other one was a Republican from Jordan.
Yeah. The guy that practically lived off the watering hole was a Republican from Jordan?
Yeah, but he seldom was in the water hole, but you know, there were free lunches and things around.
Oh.
Helena.
Yeah.
Some of the companies now have a party or a dinner.
Yeah.
He made all of those.
Yeah.
When
I was in the legislature, we referred to guys like that as park bears. They were like a park bear. You know, they were begging for goodies all the time.
Right.
That sort of thing. Well, to get back to my comment about Bill Kirkpatrick, Bill said that at the end of the, when the watering hole closed down, 7 o'clock or 7:30 or whenever that was, sometime, a short time afterward, some of the key legislators, according to him, from both parties and from both chambers, sat down there in that room or in a room right close by. And they didn't do this every day, he said, but they did it fairly frequently during the legislative session. And they just talked about the status of bills in the legislature and that sort of thing. And I said, well, Bill, I said, obviously you were talking about bills that you had an interest in, that you wanted to see passed or you wanted to see killed. And he said, that was pretty much the case. We just kind of shared information generally. And I said, and so the Anaconda Company lobbyist was in the room. And he said, yeah, sometimes more than one, maybe even several, but business interest lobbyists. And I said, did you ever decide that a particular bill should die? And he said, sure. Yeah, he said, we talked about the ones we didn't like. And I said, and you talked about the ones you wanted to have passed? And he said, certainly. And I said, well, in the time that you were there, in 1953 and 1955, when your group decided to kill a bill or when your group decided to pass a bill, did you ever fail in that? And he said, never once, Robert, never once. Does that add up to you? Had you ever heard of the little group? He said he didn't think it was unknown, and he said he thought some legislators referred to it as the school.
Well, we knew, yes, they had the control, and some of the legislators they never used unless they absolutely needed them. Well, in the 59 session in the Senate, I, me personally, and some of the rest of them, we were real good friends with the senator from Silver Bowl County, who didn't pretend to be anything else. He was a company man. But he befriended all of us. He would carry bills for us that we didn't want our name on, or didn't want to speak, you know, for whatever political reason. And we all owed him a favor.
Huh.
Well, one day, then he collected the favors. There were two ladies up on the Berkeley pit that wouldn't sell their home, two ladies. And the Anaconda Company had a bill in that they could condemn. That's the only way they could get it.
Yeah.
Well, then it's when he asked us all for the favor.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah.
Because the government can condemn property in the public interest, but there was a bill before the legislature that gave a private corporation the power to condemn this private property. But I suppose their position was they couldn't expand the Berkeley pit as long as these people held out.
Right.
And so they probably argue that hundreds of jobs depend on our ability to do this, and we're giving them a fair price, and they're just holding us up and that sort of thing. So.
And the other thing he told us, he told us the votes that the Anaconda Company had in the Senate, and he told us the number. He was exactly right, and we could not, I'm talking about us, a little group of us Democrats, we could not figure out who those people, we knew some of them, obviously. Now, some of these names now, Bob, am I going to tell you the name, and then the name will go in this record?
Well, it should, if you know it.
Well, one of them is Dave James, was the
from
leader.
From up at Liberty County.
Yes.
And he was the leader of?
He was the majority leader in the Senate.
In the Senate, yeah.
Yes. He's the one Democrat, not the only one, but he really stabbed me in the back. One, I just didn't care much for Dave James. Yeah. Well, not at all. But anyway, I was chairman in 59 of the Committee on Committees.
Which is the committee in the state Senate that appoints all the other committees.
All the right.
It's very, very important committee.
Yes. I was the chairman. Doc Anderson was the vice chairman, and the one guy from down at Hysham was the other member.
Would have been Dave Manning.
No, not Dave. Different. Dave and I were good friends.
Yeah.
Dave was really a gentleman.
Yes.
A nice, yes. Really a gentleman.
Yeah.
He didn't like to speak on bills that he was had, so he asked me if I would do it for him, and which I did. Well, he was a fine gentleman.
Yeah, I knew him well, too. Served with him as
Dave
well.
Dave Mann.
Yeah. But James was close to the Anaconda Company?
Yes. But why?
Because he was from up in Farmers Union country, where people in his district would have been surprised at that, wouldn't they?
Yes, he was a pious kind of a SOB. But anyway.
Very religious. I remember that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I was chairman of the Committee on Committees. Well, when we had our first meeting, I said, we're not going to report anything out of this committee until it's done, and we're not going to let anyone come in and talk to us until this is done, which we did. Well, we reported out to committees. Every member of the Senate got their first choice in their committee. Many of them got all their choices, but everyone got their first choice. But the only committee we didn't report, we reported them all on the same day. The only one we didn't report was the Rules Committee. And I told Dave James, as our floor leader, I said, we're not going to report this because that senator from Yellowstone County, as soon as we report it, is going to object, stand up and object. Dave says, I'll back you 100%. So I said, okay, we reported it out. The Republican senator from Yellowstone County did.
Gibbs, maybe?
Rex Hibbs.
Rex Hibbs, yeah.
Rex Hibbs.
Yeah. He would have been close to the Anaconda Company, probably. Hibbs would have been.
Well, I'd say quasi.
Yeah, oh, okay. Maybe less so than Dave James.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, so he objected.
Rex and I were good friends. We would have drinks together and stuff down at the Montana Club. And we're good friends.
Yeah.
Well, he did just what I told Dave he would do, which I expected him to do, and that damn James recessed the Senate.
And the effect of that was?
Then Dave Manning was the one that we were doubtful about.
Yeah.
Dave got up and withdrew his name from being on the committee, so we got what we wanted. But that night, the Independent Record, Democrats lose first floor fight.
Huh.
No, but,
and just so I understand, Rex Hibbs wasn't satisfied with the recommendations that the Committee on Committee made?
On the one committee, the Rules
Committee. Rules Committee.
The one committee, yeah.
He didn't like the way you structured the Rules Committee.
Right. We structured the committee so the Democrats would have control over it.
Yeah,
of course, Rex had that figured out.
Yeah. And so...
But when Dave withdrew his name, the committee evolved in just the way we wanted it, but that wasn't the way, of course, the IR.
Because the IR, of course, was owned by the Anaconda Company.
Yes, yeah. Right. They owned all they owned every paper except the
Great Falls Trip.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Did you notice then when you read the Helena IR during a legislative session, did the story seem to be biased?
Oh, yeah, that's what I said. We'd meet up here all day, and you wouldn't even, when you read the review that was in the IR, you wouldn't know it was the same legislation.
Who were the reporters? Do you remember the name of a reporter?
Gosh, yes. I guess some of those names, it takes me a little while, I can't come up with them, but...
Was J.D. Holmes a reporter for them then?
Holmes was a reporter, but he was a little fairly more independent. Yes, but he was a reporter.
Yeah, then. Okay. Let's see. What was a big bill or a big issue when you were a legislator, an important bill, an important issue?
Well, I'll give you, you want a story on?
Yes, I do.
Bills that were always important was highway construction. In either 53 or 55, the highway department came to us in the legislature and said if we would increase the tax for the highways from 6 cents to 7 cents, it would be temporary until they had some special job they wanted to do. So that was fine. We did that. We increased the fuel tax from 6 to 7 cents, and that all went to the highway department. Well, of course, in 59, they came back and they wanted to make it permanent.
Okay.
So I thought, well, now here you guys, you said this was going to be temporary and we moved it up to 7, but now you want to keep it at 7. So I had an amendment, but I didn't even tell Bob Durkee what I was going to do, was sitting next to me. And when the secretary read every section of every bill, well, I had my amendment made out to change it from 7 to 6 and took it up and stood right there and watched her. And then when she got to that section, I handed her my amendment. Well, in those days, the lieutenant governor was...
presided over the Senate, yeah.
Yeah. And he stood up. His hair fell in his eyes, his glasses fell off.
Who was he?
Cannon.
Paul Cannon?
Paul Cannon.
Yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yeah, he was an old Butte politician.
Yeah, right, and kind of a pompous kind of a guy.
Yeah.
Well, he stood up, I'm telling you, literally, his fair, like me, maybe jealous of a guy with some hair, but anyway, his hair fell down, his glasses fell on the desk, he recessed the Senate. Then the lieutenant governor's office was just across, went in, locked the door, and wouldn't answer the phone. So here we are. This was a night session. Everybody was gone, the lobbyists, nobody was around.
Yeah.
Well, then the lobbyists started to come back, the governor, I can't remember how long we sat there with Cannon locked in his office. It was a decent hour. It was quite a long time.
Because Cannon wanted to keep you from acting on this?
He didn't know how to vote. He was afraid it was going to be a tie.
Oh.
You see, the only time he had a vote is...
Sure, yeah.
Well, Cannon, then he was going to be a candidate for governor.
Yeah. You know?
Cannon didn't know how to vote. And he thought it'd be a tie. We knew it was going to be close.
Yeah.
He had lost
This was 1959.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Senate rules was the Jefferson Manual. Are you acquainted with the Jeopardy?
Well, not really.
That's the rules that the United States House uses.
Yeah, that were apparently fashioned originally by Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the Jefferson Manual was the rule book for the Montana Senate.
Okay.
Well, Cannon had lost his rule book also. He didn't know where it was. So I was the only guy in the Senate that had the rule book. My stepfather was in the United States Congress and they had given me the Jefferson Manual. So I had it.
Who was your stepfather?
Jim Haley. James A. Haley was a representative from the 7th District of Florida.
I see.
Was my stepfather.
I see.
That was really a fun night. Well,
he finally came out an hour later.
We finally got Cannon.
Somebody must have got him on the telephone and told him how to vote.
He wouldn't answer the phone.
He called somebody.
Well, he may have done that. Yeah. But anyway, the representative from over was the head of the highway department. He would have to ask me what the rules were.
He was the chairman of the highway committee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd have to ask me what the rules were, because I had the rule book and I kept it right there. Well, the two, Donovan Warden from Missoula County.
Republican senator from Missoula.
And the Republican senator from Lewis and Clark County came and voted with me. I mentioned Donovan Warden because he said if I was elected to the Senate and got on the Senate Judiciary Committee, he'd resign. Well, I did and he didn't.
Yeah.
And we became friends.
Yeah.
But, the piano player from...
Harold Polson?
No, he and Claude Kiff from Ringling used to give us entertainment. Miller Smith, J. Miller Smith.
J. Miller Smith was a senator from Lewis and Clark County.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he and Donovan Warden came over and voted with me on my amendment. And I told Bob Durkee, I said, those two guys aren't going to run again. And neither one of them did. But anyway, to make a long story short, my amendment passed in the Senate.
And it reduced
the fuel tax from 7 cents back to 6 cents.
Okay.
And then I knew the House would pass it if I could get it out of the Senate.
Yeah.
And it did.
And the reason that was a hard vote was because the contractors and maybe the labor unions all desperately wanted to build more road,
right,
provide more jobs. And you just felt the tax was high enough.
Well, I thought they should do what they promised us they would do. The highway department promised us if we would raise it from 6 to 7 in the House that for that interim, then it would go back to 6. Well, in 59, of course, they wanted to make it permanent, sevens.
And didn't the governor veto it?
No. Hugo Aronson was the governor, no.
He was okay with your position on it?
He signed the bill.
Yeah.
Of course, if he vetoed it, he vetoed the whole highway deal, you know.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to do that.
I see, because that rate was just a part of the whole highway bill.
No, right.
I see. Did you know Hugo?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Tell me about him.
I like Hugo. Hugo was, he had that secretary that worked for him from Park County, the man, you know.
Fred?
Yeah, Fred.
He's a newspaper man.
Yeah. I know that he wrote, I think he was jealous of Hugo, and he wrote those speeches. I know he put words in there that he knew Hugo couldn't pronounce or, you know. But I liked Hugo. He had a great, one time was a big doings here in Helena out at the Shrine Temple. And Hugo, of course, he said one thing about old Hugo, when I fall on my face, I'm 6 feet further ahead.
When I fall on my face, I'm 6 feet further ahead.
Yeah, further.
Further.
Yeah. Further.
Because he talked in that heavy Swedish accent.
Yeah,
I heard
right.
that too, yeah.
But I liked him. when I had my name on a bill, he would call Carl Rosted, who you know.
Yes.
And ask him if my name was on it. Hugo didn't really trust me. And if Carl gave him the okay, that it was fine with Hugo. But I liked Hugo.
Do you think Hugo was an Anaconda Company man?
I don't think he was. I think he was fairly independent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've run into that too. Other people have said the same thing, that they didn't think.
I didn't dislike Hugo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But didn't.
He was fairly conservative, I think, in his point of view.
Yes, but I do remember one thing. That was the time when we approved the new governor's mansion.
Yeah.
Hugo didn't give a damn what it looked like, but it was not going to have a copper roof.
Yeah. Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Some names here, Paul, that I'm just interested in, maybe just a, did you ever know Wellington Rankin?
Oh, yes, very well.
He was a fairly substantial rancher in that White Sulphur Springs area. Well, describe him.
Well, Wellington was a real personality, always dressed up, a real sharp attorney, and an active and a wheeler dealer kind of a guy. Had his office up in that building, right on the main street of Helena. But a terrible rancher. He had the knack of putting those ranches together, but it was a terrible operator as a rancher.
Yeah.
And Art Acre did all the legwork for him.
Arthur Acre was his law partner.
Yes. And Acre did the digging in the books and
research.
Did the research and the legwork and everything. Yeah.
So was Rankin an impressive person?
Yes. He spoke in a loud voice. You know, when he would come, the Judiciary Committee met, he about had to open the windows when Rankin came in to talk. You know,
he was an orator.
Yes.
With a good vocabulary and...
Right.
Yeah, and a big voice and a big presence and that sort of thing. But was he... But you said he was congenial with you personally?
Well, yes, and he was a good friend of my sister that's a year younger than me, and represented my sister. My mother was in the probate court for about 14 years, and just as she had things settled up, my sister sued her for part of the estate, and Rankin was her attorney.
I see. Okay. And I imagine he won.
Well, they settled it, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Shook my mother down for a pretty good chunk of money.
Rankin did, huh?
Well, my sister.
Yeah, sure. I see. Well, he was a...
And then when my sister married the second time, Rankin stood up with her.
Really?
Yes. So, I knew Rankin.
Yeah. And it sounds like generally favorably?
Well... Not just knew him. Let's put it that way.
And he was a, if you could describe him in three words. One sentence.
Three words.
Well, one sentence.
use the words brilliant. With one word. No conscience. There's three words. Well, that's the three words.
Okay, all right. Was the senator from Butte, who was the Anaconda Company inside guy, was that Frank Reardon?
Yes.
Okay, I was wondering about
that. I really like Frank. A genuinely nice
guy. I knew him a little bit, too. I was there beginning in the House when he was just leaving the Senate. And I think he was an old plumbing contractor, wasn't he? Something like
that. He may have been, but... But
as a shrewd operator.
Oh yes, yeah. A keen mind, a nice person.
Yeah. U.S. Senator James Murray.
I knew Murray, just knew him.
Yeah.
Not just basically more than I knew who he was.
Yeah.
Yes. I knew Metcalf.
Tell me about Metcalf.
Metcalf, when I first knew him, was in the Western District in Montana. Then Montana had two representatives.
Right.
And he changed, you know, he was pretty well oriented around the timber and was all for logging and everything, and then later became more of a conservationist.
But to begin with, he was all for timber harvest,
yes,
and then later on became more of a conservationist.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you meet him personally?
I knew him personally, yes. I wouldn't say we were good friends, but we weren't. I mean, I didn't know him well enough to be a friend. Now, I was a friend, I've always felt, with Mike Mansfield, but not with Lee Metcalf.
What was the basis of your friendship with Mansfield?
Well, when I went to school a couple of quarters at Missoula, he was one of my teachers. And then I got to know him through politics. And then Mike is the one, I don't know if I told it or not, but I was the administrator of the Farm Service Agency in Montana for 2 years. And the reason that I was is that Mike asked me to do it. He said, if you can either straighten it out, fit out, or we're going to close it down. You can't imagine what a slovenly outfit that Farm Service Agency in Bozeman was when I went to work there.
And what was it? Was it a clearinghouse for?
All the farm programs in Montana went through that agency.
Okay.
The conservation programs, the wheat, the barley, the grains, everything went through that office. And it was downtown on the south side of Bozeman, slovenly. One of the program specialists worked as a janitor when his job stopped at 5 p.m. as a program specialist. Then he and his wife became the janitors.
But you did manage to get it straightened out?
Well, yeah, I talked to the fellow that owned the building. I said, "You're either going to straighten this thing out or we're out of here." Well, he wasn't so sure I could do it, and I wasn't either, but I didn't. My secretary was a young woman, a girl, or I call her a girl, a young woman helping put her husband through college. And I asked her, I said, "Is the ladies' restroom as bad as the men's?" And she says, "It's worse." It was awful,
yeah.
That place.
Yeah.
You just can't imagine how bad it was. And then these goddamn program specialists who came in, and I said, "You represent the United States?" And some farmer comes from Culbertson or way off. He and his wife spend all day driving to Bozeman, probably stay all night, and meet you with their shirt open and a dirty undershirt on. It took a while, but I finally got them all to put on it. And one morning, the last specialist, when he came into work, walked in the office where I was and said, "Look, he had on a tie and a clean shirt."
Well, that's good. Paul, I'm interested in your impressions of Mansfield, especially when he was a professor. Was he how would you describe him as a teacher?
Well, I think he was an excellent, I remember him as an excellent teacher, really. And then, of course, he taught what I was interested in, was history.
Yeah. And he was, what made him a good teacher?
Well, like congeniality, and he could communicate with the students, had a good rapport with in his classes with his students, acted like he was interested in you as a student.
Would you say that that personality trait followed him into politics?
Yeah, I think so, very much so.
Yeah. He is legendary for remembering people's names.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Remember their names, whatever they're all about. And then Mike, when he traveled around Montana, he just Mike and a driver. And they stopped at every, you know, they'd be in Townsend, and they'd be in White Sulphur Springs, and they'd be in Martinsdale, and then Harlottown. And he had a friend, probably an ex-student, in every one of those towns. That's where he went. In White Sulphur Springs, it'd be the Rainbow Cafe, not the bar, but the cafe. And people would come, Mike would be there, until the driver'd look at his watch, you know, and say, we've got to go.
But he'd just sit there and visit with people who came in?
Anybody.
Just having coffee with them?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he'd maybe spend all day when Congress wasn't in session. He was back in Montana just stopping in little towns across the state and
right.
hearing what people thought about things, kind of getting a finger on the public pulse,
yes.
and so on.
Right.
Describe him in the... in one sentence or in just a few words?
Well, if I can say the word magnanimous.
Magnanimous?
Magnanimous and friendly, outgoing. Is that
yeah, that's good. Was he smart?
Oh, yes, you bet. And smart politically. And he and that Republican from Vermont, or
George Aiken,
they had breakfast together
yeah.
every morning.
Yeah, back in the
Republican US Democrat.
Yeah. Orvin Fiore.
I knew who Orvin was, and I think Orvin was. I don't think Orvin ever quite put it all together. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Wes Dewart.
I knew Wes, and of course Wes was a pretty congenial kind of a politician. He was elected and reelected. He was from out just west of Wilsall.
Leroy Anderson.
A pompous kind of a guy.
He'd been a general in World
yes,
War II.
And he never got over it.
Yeah, okay. I remember when I was just a kid, we took a field trip to Helena, and so our high school class was seated up in the Senate gallery, and this guy stood up to speak, and he had this mane of white hair,
yes.
and he had kind of a ruddy complexion. I mean, maybe like it was almost like he'd been suntanned or something, even though it's such a mint in the winter. But I remember that about him, a very imposing figure, and tall and impressive. But his voice wasn't very impressive, and that was Leroy Anderson.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a squeaky, disappointing voice coming out of a guy like that. But he was the picture of pomposity, I mean, in terms of his presence, you know, standing up and...
He was real... He was conscious of his presence.
Of his presence and his appearance, yeah. And it was impressive, at least
yes.
I thought so. But I was surprised when he started to talk. I don't know if you remember that about him or not, but he looked like he should have sounded like Wellington Rankin, but he didn't sound
That's
like Wellington
correct.
Rankin.
Yeah. And he was a farm union guy.
From up at Conrad.
Yes.
Yeah. Forrest Anderson.
Forrest was one of the last of the really worked all the angles in my that he was one of the last that was able to manipulate and work all the angles in Montana politics.
Give me an example.
Well, Forrest actually was able to milk the state, you know. He made it pay off.
Meaning that he might have been dishonest?
I don't think he was any more dishonest than anybody ahead of him. He knew how to work all the levers and everything.
Yeah. But when you say work all the levers...
Well, you know, there's a lot of... I don't know how it is up here now in Montana government, but 50 years, we're talking about a lot of years ago, there were a lot of little rattles around the state where there might be a few dollars here and there come out of it.
I see. How would you, because he was governor.
Yes.
And so was Hugo Aronson.
Yes.
How would you compare them?
I think Hugo was straighter. I'd say Hugo was not the manipulator that Forrest Anderson was.
Describe Forrest as a person.
Well, he was, as a person, I would probably have liked Hugo as a person better than I did Forrest.
Well, you know, we described Leroy Anderson.
Yes.
Forrest, to me, looked like Leroy Anderson, except he was about two-thirds as tall.
Yes, small in stature.
Very small in stature, but a very impressive guy with, you know...
A real nimble mind. Yeah, he had a much better mind than General Anderson, yes.
And so when you say he was able to... quick on his feet in terms of, like, being able to... formulate arguments and that
and
sort of
he
thing.
Knew, yes, and he knew how to, he had the ability to size up people real well and put them, you know, where he wanted them to work in his administration and that type of thing.
You think he had some pretty good people there for in his administration?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. That's kind of been his reputation from the people I've talked to. Tim Babcock.
Well, Tim and I, you know, this last... you mentioned Tim. Of course, Tim was in the legislature the same time that I was. And about 2 weeks ago now, I was on that Big Sky Honor flight that went back to...
Oh, you went back to Washington, D.C. with the World War II veterans,
yes,
along with
Tim Babcock. Tim was there. Tim was a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge. And I think I received a Bronze Star there.
Yes.
But I love Tim. We've known each other well for all, and visited her a couple of times on this trip. We were never friends, but we weren't unfriendly either. But we knew each other. Of course, we were on opposite sides.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Tim had a sweetheart, which you probably knew.
Well, he was governor, or
yes,
yeah,
and before and after. Well, when I was in the office at Bozeman, and there sometimes there'd be something. Tim was governor. There'd be sometimes when the federal government and the state government would have to work together. So I'd call her. We knew each other.
Yeah.
We were friendly, but I mean just friends.
Uh-huh.
I'd call her and explain the whole deal, and she okayed it, and well, then Tim would sign it or whatever, you know, cooperate.
And what was her...
I'm not going to...
Did she work in his office? Or
yes, she was his secretary.
Okay, I see, okay. And this was while he was governor?
Yes.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, he later had the Colonial out here.
Yeah.
But when I first remembered the Colonial, it was just a pasture around a nightclub. It wasn't like it is now. And for instance, Jorgensen's, when I was first here, that whole complex wasn't here.
Yeah.
There was one place to eat, mostly one place to eat downtown.
Yeah. Well, the original Colonial was out by the airport, wasn't it? It's a little white, red and white building out by the airport.
No, not by the airport. It's kind of out where it is now. But there was nothing around it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was quite a guy in the trucking business, too, before he became governor.
Before he was in the legislature, he was in Babcock and Lee trucking company out of Miles City.
Do you remember anything about him as a legislator?
Yes, yes, I can remember him. Mostly voted with his party.
Yeah.
I can't remember him with any particular legislation, but voted with his party, obviously.
Jim Batten.
Jim was a big, kind of a bunch of hot air. He wasn't a very competent attorney. The firms that he was in could hardly afford him. He didn't. But he was another politician.
Yeah. In terms of being friendly and... When you say a politician?
He was an agile type politician. Jim and I weren't friendly at all. He was in the legislature.
Yeah.
When, at the same time that I was, he was... he was inclined to be a little pompous. And, of course, I wasn't... I was on the Judiciary Committee, but was not an attorney.
Yeah.
And he couldn't imagine this guy, you know, working on law that wasn't an attorney.
Arnold Olson.
Arnold... I knew Arnold quite well. And he was always worried about the... how his appropriation would come, and my seat...
This is when he was Attorney General. He was concerned about his appropriation.
And my seat was right by the door as you come in the Senate. Well, Arnold would always have somebody come, and I told him, Arnold, you're going to have to quit calling me out of the Senate. Just stay down there on the next floor and leave me alone. You know, I'm trying to... follow the legislation and stuff, and we'll watch out for you. You don't have to worry about us.
Describe him in just a few words.
I liked Arnold, and Arnold was a politician, not as quite as smart as some of them, maybe a little insecure.
I'm going to ask you about a couple of legislators before we end our interview here and give you an opportunity, of course, to expand anything you'd like to. George Siderius?
George and I were real good friends. George was from over in western Montana.
Senator from Flathead.
Yes. I like George. We were real good personal friends, and I thought was an excellent legislator.
And he was an agriculturalist. He was a farmer,
yes.
Had been a school teacher.
Yes.
Do you remember any legislation he might have been involved in or any experience you had with him?
He was on the Judiciary Committee, and he despised that committee. So I had a deal with him. He didn't have to, I'd always mark him as president, but he didn't have to come unless I needed his vote. It was just an agreement between he and I.
Sure. So he was close to you and trusted you.
We were good friends.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tom Haines.
Haines.
Republican from Missoula.
Yes. He was kind of austere. Well, that's the word I'd use to him.
Not real friendly.
No.
Yeah.
No, and we weren't friends. We weren't really enemies, but... we weren't friends. He was austere, kind of.
He was a businessman. I know.
Held him pretty close to himself.
Jake Frank.
Oh, I knew him. Jake and I were good friends. Were friends for. I knew Jake before I was ever in the legislature. Jake was from down at the Park City, Park City.
Yeah. Was he a colorful character, an interesting character, a controversial character?
Well, I'm not sure. He was colorful, and Jake was pretty much a Farmers Union kind of a representative.
Yeah.
Was elected down there. And
would have been somewhat radical in his politics, at least in his day and age.
He was a little. He was a dedicated Democrat.
Yeah.
Yes. I like Jake. Jake and I were good personal friends.
Mervyn Dempsey?
I remember Mervyn. Mervyn,
Democrat from Butte?
Yes, and a company guy.
And a company guy, yeah.
Yes. And I liked him. Yes.
he had a partner from there who had kind of the same reputation. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a guy by the name of John Cunningham.
Cunningham, I mostly knew who he was.
Yeah. I mentioned their names because when I interviewed Jake Frank, there was an altercation between Jake and Dempsey and Cunningham. And Jake suspected that Dempsey and Cunningham were pretty close with the Anaconda Company and perhaps had shared some information that they shouldn't have that came out of your Democratic Party caucus with them. I don't know if you know the story or not.
The caucuses, and there was always the caucus.